You're listening to the ISF podcast for your organization's better cybersecurity. Your host, ISF CEO Steve Durbin, is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, we're back for the second half of Steve's recent emerging threats webinar for security leaders. In this episode, Steve responds to audience questions and covers everything from government regulation to supply chain to raising awareness within your organization.
What I'm going to do now is take some of your questions because I can see that there's a number of those that are coming in. So I go to my iPad. Let's have a look and see what questions we've got. There's quite a lot here, actually. Okay, let's take this one at the top here. Oh, geopolitical, I like those. So the first one, with geopolitical tensions and nation-state activity at an all-time high, how close do you think we are to seeing an actual cyber war? And can organizations prepare for this, and how? Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it? I think it depends very much on how we define cyber war. I think the reality is that cyber has already been pretty much integrated into the sorts of warfare that we've been seeing. Maybe not frontline, but certainly behind the scenes in terms of preparing the ground, some of the old spy-type James Bond-like stuff that exists out there. So I would say if we're talking about that component of cyber warfare, then we're already there. And I don't think that's changing. The more important piece for me, though, is this question about how can organizations prepare for it and how might they do that? I think that this takes us into, from an ISF standpoint anyway, what we always call protecting the crown jewels. Now, we've been talking about this for a number of years, but basically, for those of you who are not members, who are perhaps not familiar with it, what it involves is you identifying your highly business-critical assets, the ones that you can't do without, and making sure that irrespective of what might be happening, those are protected. And those will change over time, so it's very important to keep that up to date, to keep reviewing them, and also to run some simulation exercises around what the impact might be of those being attacked, unavailable, or corrupted in any way so that you can't use them. So there is actually the good news. There is a lot of work that organizations can do to make sure that in the event of being impacted by cyber warfare or indeed ordinary warfare, that your critical assets are protected. But you need to do the work now. And that's the answer to that one. What else have we got here? Oh, this one's related to it, so I'll take this one. The world is in a state of flux, which is having an impact on how organizations can operate safely. In your discussions with board members, why do you emphasize that it's important to include cyber risk as part of their business strategy? Well, the answer to this one, I think, is pretty simple, and it does gel with the board members that I talk to. The important piece is to make the link between cyber and what the business is actually doing. So if your business has got anything at all to do with technology and moving data, then cyber risk is something that you need to be considering. Because there isn't an organization out there today that can exist without access to its data. And as soon as we start getting involved in data access, we're into the world of cybersecurity. So boards actually do get that. What is interesting is that it then leads to quite an interesting conversation around what are the implications of that? How do we go about protecting it? And I'm back to how we started this Q&A, which is around the critical assets and how do we protect those? So it's a really important issue. Boards do get it. And actually, I've found it's quite a useful way of introducing a perhaps broader discussion around the way in which cybersecurity should be rolled out across the organization in order to make it much more resilient and able to withstand some of the challenges that we face. Okay, what else have we got here? Oh, here we go. There's one on AI. That's quite interesting. With the pace of AI adoption across business and personal environments, how have the skills required to work in cybersecurity changed? And is the potential for machines to replace humans even more of a threat? Interesting in a number of levels, that. So my personal take on this is that the skills required to work in cybersecurity certainly have changed. I'm all about looking at it from the business standpoint. So what I'm going to say probably won't surprise you. I like bringing people into the cyber space that are not technical. That doesn't mean to say you don't need technical people in cyber. You do. Your security team needs to have a combination of the two. But I do very much like bringing them in from the business because their perspective is very much more about how they're going to make use of the technologies and therefore the use and the role that cybersecurity can play in securing the critical assets. So that's a sort of a fresh perspective. Now, what it does, because we obviously are in an industry where there's a shortage of skills, what it does do is open up the markets to attracting, if you get it right, a whole variety of people that perhaps you wouldn't normally be able to bring into cybersecurity. So not only does it give you fresh perspective, not only does it align you more closely with the business, but it also opens up a pool of talent that otherwise might not be there. Now, the second piece of that, which is, you know, is the potential for machines to replace humans even more of a threat, is also interesting because the views on this are somewhat polarized. I'm not of the school that says that machines are going to take over the world and that we're all doomed to sit on our sofas doing nothing other than twiddling our thumbs all day because the machines will do it all for us. I do think that there is a role that we haven't yet defined that needs to be really sorted out in every organization and indeed in society in general as to how we combine the best skill sets available on the machine side with the best skill sets available on the people side. So AI, for instance, is very good at doing a number of things, but people are also very good at doing a number of things. Those organizations that have managed to marry those two together, where they're getting the best from AI and the best from their people, are the ones, I think, that are going to achieve some significant competitive advantage in the short and much longer term. So I don't see a world in which machines replace humans. I do see a world in which we work much more collaboratively, technology and human interface, people, to achieve more interesting things. So that's my perspective on it. What else here? Oh, this one's interesting. Could get myself into trouble on this one. What role should governments play in helping businesses to deal with emerging threats? The role of government. I think you can sit in a number of different camps on this. I subscribe to the view that government should do what government is good at and stay away from what it's not good at. So in terms of helping business, I think what we need is clarity. We need to have some very clear guidelines. If we're going to have regulation, for instance, then make it easy to understand, sensible, but then don't get involved. Let businesses do what they do best, which is run the business. So where government begins to interfere in the running of the business or creates an environment that is hostile to business, then government has got it wrong. And government needs to step back and think very long and hard. Now, that requires, of course, you to have people in government who are experienced in working in business. And all too often, we see career politicians getting involved in these kinds of things who really don't have the first idea how to run a business. So the role for government is to listen, to consult with people who understand what they're talking about, and then to provide very clear guidelines. There's also another role, and that is to help and support smaller organizations, encourage much more of an entrepreneurial environment so that businesses are able to thrive and develop, particularly in line with the way in which people need to develop and society needs to develop. So government, if it gets it right, can play an absolutely pivotal role in encouraging investment, encouraging business confidence. But in order to do that, it needs to first understand the market, consult widely, and put in place sensible regulation that assists rather than deters. Oh, I'll do this one because it's related to what I was just saying. How do you believe regulatory compliance becomes a help rather than another tick box exercise? I think that it's allied to what I was just saying about governments, about sensible regulation. Now, the sad thing at the moment, I think, is that we're beginning to see fragmentation where it comes to regulation. So different parts of the world introducing different regulatory environments. I had hoped some years back, round about the time that GDPR was introduced, that we were moving to a space where we were going to see a little bit more conformity around regulation around the world. I don't think we're in that space anymore, sadly. And so I do think that where we're going to end up is a little bit more fragmentation around it. But the interesting piece is, how do you avoid it becoming a tick box compliance exercise? And I think that's about regulators perhaps going to the next stage and trying to give some form of explanation as to why some of these things might be important. But really, you know, the onus is back on the board of organizations to make a call as to how stringent they wish to be in terms of observing that regulation, whether it be very light touch or whether it be in much more detail. I'm thinking in particular of some of the financial services organizations here that don't have too much of a choice in this space. But the organization needs to understand better the impact of some of those regulations on how they run their business, and very importantly, on the people. So if you do have to have conformance with fairly stringent regulation, think about how you can get your people engaged in that. Don't go through something like an annual process where they have to complete, you know, a whole series of questions to demonstrate their compliance, because that is then a tick box exercise. So make it a much more living exercise. We talk about this all the time in terms of security awareness and security good practice. You know, reinforce, have nudges, make regulation a living thing in your organization. That will steer you away from just the tick box stuff, which is pretty tedious for everybody and actually probably not as effective as what I've just suggested. Okay, what else have we got? Here we are. Aligning security to business needs. I keep hearing CISOs need to do that and fail because they've never learned how to. But I'm not aware of any case studies or guidelines on how to do that on a practical level. Now, I'm not sure whether the person asking this question is an ISF member or not. And the reason I say that is that if you are an ISF member, then there are a number of different case studies and examples that you can access via ISF Live, or indeed simply by talking to your account manager or one of the research team, that will give you some of that insight into how you can best deal with that. If you're not an ISF member, then again, you can access some of these case studies. You just need to either give me a call and I'll point you in the right direction. And my details will be available at the end of this. Or indeed, you know, pop onto our website and have a look around there. Because we do quite a lot of work in that. And also, we do showcase some of these things at our events. So, for instance, we were in Orlando fairly recently, back in November, for our annual Congress. And we had over 40, almost 50, in fact, member presentations that were actual case studies on how they make security come alive within their organizations, how they deal with some of these particular issues. And then, of course, there is also the collaboration environments that we provide. But the ISF isn't alone in doing that. Lots of other organizations out there that provide those sorts of things. So my reaction to that is there are case studies available. You just need to ask if you're an ISF member. And if you're not, then why not become an ISF member? But you'd expect me to say that. Okay, what else have we got on here? Oh, I like this one. Right, how can organizations be better at monitoring the threat to them that exists in their supply chain? This is something that I'm asked a lot. Now, at the ISF, we've been looking at this whole sort of supply chain security piece for, gosh, very many years, probably as many as 10 years ago, we started doing fairly significant work in this space. And more recently, as members will know, we've introduced a number of different software solutions for our members to use, not least of which being our supply chain assurance app, which is available through ISF Assure. But how do you actually monitor that? I think it's a combination of things. It is about having a very clear idea as to which organizations sit in your supply chain and the role that they play in the supply chain. So our supply chains have become very, very complex. And as I said in the presentation, you know, they cross a huge number of geographies and jurisdictions. So what's important is to understand who the key suppliers are and also their key suppliers. So there's a little bit of fairly tedious work involved in sort of breaking all of that down. But once you've done that, what you can begin to do is assess the security level across those. You can do that by benchmarking them. You can do that by auditing them if you've got the ability to do it, or you can get a third party to do it for you. But it's important to understand how each of those key suppliers is handling your data, how it's operating with you, And again, as I said in my earlier presentation, to provide some help and assistance to them as to what you expect them to do, how they can go about doing it, and if necessary, provide some additional support along the way. Now, very large organizations obviously have third-party supply sections in their organizations that look after this. The smaller ones obviously don't. And so I think there's also a role for large organizations to play in terms of working with some of the smaller key suppliers to help them raise the level of security. And again, from an ISF standpoint, you know, we have a number of different options that are available with things like our supply chain membership offering. We also provide working groups where organizations can get together. And as I mentioned, our ISF Assure package of software really provides a whole range of different tools that allow you to enable better security across the overall supply chain. So again, if you're not a member, take a look at our website and you'll be able to see what we've got to offer in that space. Okay, this one's interesting. The world is in a state of flux, which is having an impact on how organizations can operate safely. How do you include cyber risk as part of the business strategy? I don't actually differentiate very much anymore between cyber risk and enterprise risk. Now, some people would think that's the wrong thing to do, but bear with me. The reason I don't is that for me, I've become very much more convinced that cyber is so integral in everything that we do, as I've said before, that actually you create something of a problem for yourself if you begin to differentiate between enterprise and cyber. So there's no real need for you to make that differentiation. Now, within large organizations, of course, you've had an enterprise risk management structure in place for very many years. And what you don't want to do is to try to reinvent the wheel. So I do see in some organizations a combining of cyber and enterprise risk. Personally, I view that as being a good thing because you get a holistic perspective then on risk and how that can be made to work for you in your organization in terms of managing your overall risk profile. And what I've found by talking to boards is that they like that because they don't very often understand the difference between the two. Because if you think about it, you know, if you've got a risk that's going to impact your business strategy and the way in which you're developing your organization, it doesn't really matter whether it's physical, cyber, or anything else for that matter. You need to deal with it. And so how you go about doing it by having them all together in one place seems to make sense. I know that other people will disagree, and I know that there are other ways of doing these things, but that's certainly my take on it at the moment. Another one here that's on education and awareness. How can we evolve education and awareness campaigns as business needs evolve to maintain colleague engagement? That's a really good question because it's the colleague engagement piece that is important in all of this. And I like the word evolve in the question as well because that's the way I see it working. I think in the old days, if you sort of roll it back, you know, 10, 15 years or whatever, awareness was all about mugs and posters and T-shirts and caps and all of that kind of thing. Given that we have hybrid organizations today where not everybody's in an office environment, it doesn't really seem to make much sense to me to have somebody, you know, wearing a cap and a T-shirt, drinking their tea or coffee out of a mug, sitting on their own at home. So I think that we have to move much more to a technology-based solution where we are using nudges on an ongoing basis. So I'm not in favor of having, as I said, with the regulatory compliance answer, you know, a set of particular exams, if you like, as to how you should be improving your cyber hygiene. I think what is far more effective is in-the-moment feedback or in-the-moment nudges that remind people about what good looks like. And you know, I'm going to repeat something that I said in the presentation because it's so important. And that is, we need to make it simple for our users to be able to contact somebody in security if they are at all concerned about something that they've seen, either through their email, on a system, and all too often we're not doing that. So that's a really simple fix. I know I'm repeating myself, but I can't tell you the number of times I've spoken to organizations and they simply aren't doing some of those basics. We don't need to complicate all the time. So I'm very much a fan of keeping things simple. Another one here, which is interesting, on physical security. So physical security has become very important for many companies in Europe during 2024. How do you see these physical versus cybersecurity risks, and where should companies really focus? Now, I think this depends to a certain extent on which industry sector you happen to be in. So if you happen to be in critical national infrastructure, for instance, and let's say it's, I don't know, electricity generation or something like that, you're going to find it very difficult to differentiate between the physical and the technological security elements. And the answer is you need to be managing both. The same applies to things like logistics and so on. One of the things that I found quite interesting talking to our members is that in those sorts of organizations, say manufacturing, logistics, we've seen a combining of the security functions, so putting physical and cyber together. And that's because you can actually make much more sense, I suppose, to the end user, to colleagues across the business, by having a one-stop shop for security. We're also seeing an increase in the amount of technology that's going into managing physical security. And so again, if you're using technology in any way, shape, or form, cyber comes into play. So it does make sense to combine the two things. So, you know, in answer to where should companies really focus, I would go back to, and I'm becoming a bit of an old record on this, but I go back to this trying to identify your critical assets, your crown jewels. And that may be some of the physical components, or it may be some of the data components. But the process of trying to identify that and understand really what you should be doing and where you should be focusing is the same, irrespective. So putting the two things together, I think, is a good thing. I like that. As I say, we're seeing a number of members that are moving down that particular road. And I think it does make life a little easier for everyone, actually. Oh, this was to the US. Okay. Need to have one of these in there. So the incoming Trump administration has said it will impose high taxes and tariffs for suppliers importing goods into the United States. What measures should businesses put in place to assess the risks their suppliers may expose them to? So we've talked a lot, actually, in the last, whatever it is, 20 minutes or so, about supply chain, haven't we, and suppliers in general. So this is another twist on the risk that your third parties may introduce into your corporate ecosystem. Again, I think it's about a couple of things. It's about understanding better what some of these implications are going to mean for your organization. And it won't be the same for everyone. So if you're a manufacturing organization, it'll mean one thing. Financial services could be something different. But the important piece is to really do that assessment as to exactly what's involved, how it's going to impact you. And then I think work with your suppliers so that they understand some of those implications. Very often I encourage organizations to get their key suppliers together to talk about some of these issues. And I did a podcast not too long ago, I think it's going to drop in the next few weeks, on this particular issue around supply chains. And what we were talking about in that was the need for much more cross-company communication, collaboration around some of these particular issues. And that could involve governments as well. So as in this instance, you know, where we're talking about the imposition of tariffs and so on, having that kind of understanding as to where an administration is coming from, what it's going to be introducing, the impact that will have across your supply chain. There's no getting away from the fact that you're going to have to get some legal people involved in all of this. Again, it could be an issue for some of the smaller organizations. So the role of the big organization is to help out some of those suppliers, because if you know, that may be your Achilles heel. Another one here, what collaboration? Oh, this one's on threat actors. This one's quite interesting. What collaboration do you predict between different threat actors, for instance, ransomware and nation state? If we look at the whole area of cybercrime, then I've always described it as a fairly agile growth industry, very entrepreneurial. And I don't think this is any different. So how do I see that developing, evolving? Well, we know already that there are some very sophisticated networks that have been developed that do combine nation state, for instance, with other cybercrime gangs. We know that ransomware is being used in a number of different ways. I don't think it's going to get any better. from the good guy's point of view. I think we're always going to have to face some of these challenges. I think there is a key role for law enforcement to deal with that, but I think that organizations have a role to play as well. I don't think we're going to get to a point where we're going to have certain governments ever agree to spill the beans on some of the nation state threat actors that they've got, that they're harboring, frankly, in their countries. So I think we need to understand that that is going to be the status quo, and we need to implement and adapt our defenses accordingly. And that does mean taking us back again to looking at our critical assets, looking at where they are being shared, how they're being shared, how we protect them, and also just thinking about the physical piece as well, thinking about some of our people too that we might have working in certain jurisdictions and how we might protect them in the way in which they are accessing data. Because as I say, I think that the situation is going to remain pretty much as it is. It's a very large industry. I don't think we can take it down completely. I think it's something that we're going to have to live with, frankly. Okay, another one interesting here. Do traditional risk assessments help address the new threat landscape? Or do we need to think more outside the box to prepare our organizations? Yes and no, really. I think it depends on sort of risk assessment that you're running across your enterprise. I mean, you know, if I look at it from an ISF standpoint, as you would expect, you know, we have a number of different risk assessment tools, both on the qualitative side and quantitative side. So members can take their pick on that. I think, again, in our instance, we work very, very hard to make sure that those tools are kept as up to date as possible. So we have a thing called the Standard Good Practice, which is provides the foundation for all of the things that we do. That's constantly updated with our threat registers. We will be releasing our new Threat Horizon 2027 in February next year. So that will take the threats that we've identified, drop it into our risk assessment tools. So if you're a member of the ISF using some of these things, you can pretty much guarantee that you're going to be as up to date as certainly we can help you be in terms of dealing with that particular issue. But to the point about thinking outside the box, because I like this one a lot, what we have found is by running our cyber simulation exercises around the world, and we've done a tremendous number of those over the last 18, 24 months, that does help people who participate think outside the box, because not only does it stress test the organization, and we do them from the board level right the way down to technical levels. So it does stress test it, but it also helps people come up with different solutions along the way that perhaps they wouldn't have come up with had they not gone through what is quite a stressful simulation exercise. So I think the answer to that is, do the traditional risk assessments help? Yes and no. Those that are kept constantly up to date, those that are linked to some of the simulation exercises I've just been talking about, they do. There's no doubt about that. And certainly the people that we've worked with in developing those and running them have seen benefit. Right. I know I'm running out of time. I'm just going to do this one because it's a little bit of a shameless plug for the ISF. And it's, what role does the ISF play in helping organizations to maintain cyber resilience? Cyber resilience, first of all, I'd say, is the way that we all have to go. It's not about if we're going to get attacked, it's about when we're going to get attacked, how we're going to recover from that. I've talked a lot in this session about things like risk assessments, about our cyber simulation exercises. What we try to do is provide our members with a range of insights via our research programs into the way in which cybersecurity is evolving, is changing, Threat Horizon being an example of that, securing the cloud being another example of that. We also provide them with tools to help enable some of those things. And I think more importantly, perhaps, we provide them with access to experts within the organization, within the ISF, and also within other member organizations that they can discuss these things with. So it's a number of different things. It's about research, it's about tools, it's about collaboration, learning, education, insight. And for those of you listening to this who aren't members of the ISF, I would encourage you to take a look at our website. There are also some interesting downloads attached to this particular webinar that you can take a look at I think we've got one of our earlier threat horizons in there. I think we've got something on the cloud. We've got something about managing security the ISF way. Whole range of different things. So please do take a look at those. So thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for joining us for this week's episode. In the meantime, if you enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast, and we'd be pleased if you'd consider sharing the episode. To become a member, get in touch with Steve directly at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or on LinkedIn. Check out all our media and resources. All of it is there to support you at securityforum.org. Don't miss our other podcast, Dear InfoSec, sharing conversations with members about the real-world applications of ISF research. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox Productions and Tavia Gilbert. Thanks for listening.